Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How can we ride the emotional roller coaster of difficult times? Lily Ning talks with Martinus Becker about building emotional resilience.
How do we ride the emotional roller coaster of difficult times? I'm in conversation with Martinus Becker, a clinical psychologist and expert in dialectical behavioral therapy for young people. Welcome, Martinus.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Just from the outset, I want to acknowledge that these are challenging and uncertain times, and that people might feel quite distressed as we're talking about emotional states. So I would encourage people to call a crisis helpline or hospital-based mental health services if they feel distressed. Firstly, Martinus, can you explain what emotions are and why we have them?
I think emotions are awesome, all of them. Anger, sadness, anxiety, you know, they all helped us to act quickly, to shape our thoughts in the moment, our body's like physical responses, and ultimately that urges to act in a particular way. Essentially, they provide us with like a really quick automatic communication to us and other people around us. If we had to manually figure out our best reaction in any given situation, ranging from crossing the road or talking to a friend or family member, we'd be very slow and sometimes rather dangerous. So instead, we have these quick automatic experiences called emotions that guide us through life much more efficiently. I suppose the challenge comes that with any automatic system like that is it's going to have some inaccuracy when it does it that quickly. So at times we perceive danger when there is none, or the intensity of our emotions end up like paralyzing us instead of motivating us.
You've mentioned that emotions can be helpful, but they can be deeply unhelpful.
Every emotion has a function. Joy drives connection. Shame stops me acting against my like community's values, or guilt stops me acting against my own values. Anger can motivate me, anxiety prepares me, and so forth. So emotions become unhelpful when they no longer serve that function well, when the intensity or the type of emotion doesn't really match the situation, and they don't help us anymore. They don't help us kind of navigate through the world.
It's quite a difficult world to navigate through at the moment.
It is.
What are the benefits of being aware of our emotional state?
In DBT, one of the key skills that we teach is mindfulness. And, you know, mindfulness is utilized in lots of ways. One of the ways we use it is to heighten awareness. Because if we are aware of our emotions, of our thoughts, of our urges, of all those bits that go with emotion, then those automatic emotions that I was talking about earlier, like, it gives us a chance to do something different, to choose a different way of responding to them, a more effective way, a way that helps us move forward closer to our goals. So like that emotional awareness is absolutely key. Without it, we often feel like emotions just rolling away from us, a slave to them, or just kind of going with them without being able to actually do something when they pop up. So yeah, awareness is absolutely key, both in ourselves and other people as well.
I'm going to back up a little bit because you are an expert in dialectical behavioral therapy, which is DBT. Sure. And perhaps you can explain a little bit about what that entails, because it was Marsha Linehan who first developed the principles of DBT.
Marsha did this back in the 90s. DBT is something that I'm very passionate about, and I think for good reason. The first book on it was called Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Borderline Personality Disorder. At its core, it is still CBT. Or like cognitive behavioral therapy. And CBT often is a way of understanding the world in terms of the thoughts and behaviors that keep us acting and feeling the way that we do in the moment. And it's often kind of practiced in getting a core set of skills, teaching people new skills, new ways of like taking on their thoughts or their behaviors. And it wasn't working for a lot of people. It wasn't working for people with quite strong emotions in particular, strong emotions that led to them doing really ineffective things like harming themselves or leaning heavily on substances. And they were dropping out of therapy, or therapists were getting burnt out. So DBT came along and put a structure around CBT skills. That structure involves teaching skills through group So we always get our skills taught, no matter what crises are going on for people, as well as individual therapy too, to help understand where skills are necessary. Things like phone coaching to get skills to show up in the moment. Because ultimately, if we want to change the way things go forward, we have to have a new behavior show up in the moment where we most need it. And the whole structure of DBT is set up around that, including the team that I work in called a consult, who, yeah, work to keep each other well. So hence why DBT therapists, when you meet them, are often very passionate, because we live and breathe these skills. We use them ourselves. Yeah, once you kind of see the DBT way of life, it takes over a bit.
So you're opening up an emotional space for people to express what they're feeling, which also decreases their physiological arousal. And I just wondered if you could speak to the advantages of articulating what it is we are feeling.
Articulating how we're feeling is really beneficial. Before, when I was talking about emotion and its function, right, and where it's unhelpful when it no longer meets its function. Its function is to communicate to us and to other people. If I'm not able to articulate emotion effectively, it can get really confusing, because sometimes the way my face looks or my body responds, my body language, doesn't fit with how I actually feel. So I'm trying to portray something that's not going on for me. And that might actually come from me not understanding what I feel. You know, a lot of people, when I ask them what's going on, would tell me, I feel angry. And very rarely when someone feels angry, is that the emotion that really underlies it? Because somewhere underneath it, they've lost something and they're feeling sad. Or somewhere in the future, something they're really worried about and they're anxious. Or, you know, they've been blocked from something that's really important for them. So anger often shows up after that, and understanding that and being able to articulate that I'm sad that I have lost this and you've had a part in that, that's why I'm angry at you, helps so much to have us communicate with other people, but also for me to target my efforts towards my sadness rather than the anger, which is kind of a consequence of it.
There's a term used in psychiatry called alexithymia.
Yeah.
And that is literally no words to describe feeling.
Yeah.
And people then typically find it difficult to respond to rising stress until that distress is fully blown.
Yeah.
How do you counsel people who have difficulty even describing and identifying their feelings?
It really starts with understanding them first. You know, I think when I do professional development, even for colleagues, people who work in mental health, and I pose the question of what are emotions, the most common answer I get is feelings. And if I then pose the opposite question of what are feelings, they say emotions. And I think it's something that sometimes we get this, like, we feel like we inherently understand it, but actually really understanding it, like, what is it? How does it work? What's the parts of it? It's something that we're not actively taught very often. In terms of counseling clients to be able to do that, it's understanding that model first. So explaining a model of emotion. How does this all fit together? Like, how does a trigger lead to a way of interpreting it through to then the sensations in my body and the urges to act in a particular way? And then being able to tune them into any aspect of that they may be able to pick up on. So looking for clues and, okay, well, right now you might not have the words, but scan your body and tell me what you feel. Is there something in your chest? Is there something in your muscles, in your head? Any sensation, doesn't have to make sense, just let me know. And then trying to fill out the rest of the model from there. So we can start anywhere in the model to then try get the rest of the model out there as well.
What about tuning into the emotional states of other people? Why might that be important?
Oh, yeah. So that function of emotion in terms of communicating to other people, right? If I see you react to something on this conversation, you give me a sudden, I'm going to be looking really closer or try to listen for what's happened there, right? Because your emotion communicates to me. And being aware of that in other people, being good at picking up other emotions, means I have a better chance of responding effectively, responding in a way that helps me, one, to help you, or to kind of maintain or foster this relationship. It's a great point to doing this, is just letting people know that I get what they're saying. So we often run on this assumption that people know that I know how they feel. And actually, when we do this thing where we just tell them how they've let us know they feel, sometimes we find out that we got it just right and they go, oh yeah, you get it. And sometimes we don't get it right and they go, no, that's not how I feel. And we have this great opportunity to find out how they actually feel and what's going on there. Yeah, I think tuning into other people's emotional states, that helps us just respond more effectively, more accurately. Sometimes, I don't know, a lot of people I work with, both clinicians and clients, they have this fear that they'll get it wrong. But getting it wrong gives us a chance to get more information, to actually find out what's actually going on. So it's, yeah, a good place to start.
It brings to mind some ideas about perspective taking and this concept of theory of mind, how we are held in the mind of another. Can you talk about skills that can help people navigate particularly strong emotions?
If we're talking about strong emotions, we have to start by kind of knowing that most emotions last 90 seconds. I think it was a neurophysiologist that kind of made that claim. Most people kind of fall off the chair and go, wait a second, let me tell you about a time where I had emotions that were way longer, way stronger than that. And I think a lot of that's because emotions are self-perpetuating. They kind of keep themselves going through the ways that we're thinking, the things that we do in response to them, whatever they may be. So for instance, if I act on an urge to share my joy with other people, people smile and tell me other stories and I keep feeling happy. So that joy gets perpetuated beyond the 90 seconds. So if I'm thinking about skills and keeping that in mind, in the first instance, I'm trying to just break that cycle. I'm trying to break the next thing I'm going to do to keep this emotion going. And in DBT, we often use things like TIP skills. Now, TIP skills is an acronym where T is for temperature. Temperature here being something that's actually called the dive reflex. Interesting thing, mammals have this reflex where if we hold our breath and get down into really cold water, our whole physiological system calms down. So for dolphins, for instance, it makes perfect sense, right? Because they can hold their breath and just really chill as they go deep under. But we have the same reflex. So we can kind of hack things like that to like just dunk our water in some icy water, hold it there as long as we can, and get that same physiological calming to break that cycle of that physiology maintaining it. Or like just doing jumping jacks. So that's the iron tip, intense exercise, right? Doing them till you just can't anymore, burpees, whatever it may be. You try feeling really angry whilst you're just like absolutely exhausted and panting and actually doing some really important physiological work and countering some of those bits through to things like paced breathing and that kind of thing. Those simple skills there are things that just break that cycle. Now, one thing to really note here though is once we've knocked down that intensity of emotion, these are essentially ways of avoiding emotion, right? I'm putting something else in to break the cycle, not feel this way, not think about it. That's what all I ever do, then I'll have to keep needing these skills. So, you know, I think thinking about ways that I can then like respond to that emotion once the intensity is knocked out of it, give me really helpful. One skill that I always come back to is acting opposite. You know, I think if I feel anxious, our urge is to avoid and escape. And if I avoid or escape a thing that isn't actually dangerous to me, then I keep being scared of it, even though it doesn't make sense. So acting opposite means I go do the thing. As long as it's logically safe to do, I go do the thing. And my anxiety comes down. And I feel sad, I want to isolate in my room, do the like stereotypical thing, draw the curtains, watch Netflix, eat some ice cream. The more I hold myself in that space, the longer I'm going to feel sad. And when I then act opposite to that, when I force myself out of the bedroom, get dressed, get out, see someone, or Zoom at the moment, give someone a call, go for a walk around the block, whatever it may be, act opposite to that urge that comes from my sadness starts to shift. So I think first instance, if the emotion's just so strong, break the cycle, do something intense, temperature, exercise, whatever it may be, and then start thinking about how does this emotion actually shift long term.
There are some emotions that people feel which are overwhelming, so strong and intense, that leads them to those urges to harm themselves in quite destructive ways.
Yeah.
Can you speak to how to counter those urges?
We often think about those urges that come up to harm ourselves as problem solving. Someone's in a position where they feel so overwhelmed, so awful, and of course their brain is going to come up with ways of feeling different. And when they come up stumped, then things like harming themselves or ending their lives come up as an option. It comes up in their head and they go, oh yeah, this makes sense because I haven't got something else. Coming up with other options to knock down the intensity of emotion. And that comes back to actually those skills that we were just talking about then. It's actually not any different there. It's about doing something else to knock that the intensity of emotion down long enough for me to ride out that urge that is driving me to want to hurt myself or end my life. Now, I know that seems really simple. And again, if that's all we ever do, then we get stuck in that cycle and we often end up feeling like that more frequently. And in the moment when those urges are really strong, dunk your head in a bucket of ice. You know, watch the funniest movie that you can. Watch the scariest movie that you can. Try feel really sad when you're watching just like a really terrifying movie. Change your emotion in some way. Reach out to people around you. A limit to that becomes people going, well, I don't want to share all my issues with them. I don't want to tell them about my things. You don't have to. You can have a chat about The Widow or the latest Netflix show, something to distract you or create a different emotion to get through that moment. And once you got through it, then start thinking about how that emotion can change longer term. And that's where therapists come into it, right? Get some help. Go ask your GP or someone that can actually direct you in the right direction and how that can be different. So in the moment, get through it in any way possible to put that behavior as far away from you as can, and then finding ways to change that emotion more longer term that brought that up.
It sounds a bit like a crash course in emotional survival. One of the things that I'm thinking about is you can't make things better straight away, and you can't necessarily make someone's life feel like it's worth living. So these difficult emotions that persist and where people actually have to dwell in them, that could be extremely difficult.
Absolutely. And I love that term that you used there of a life worth living. It's a very DBT term, because when we think about DBT and the ultimate goal for us, it's a life worth living. And the journey towards that's a long one. Often the young people that come to us, it's not like they started feeling sad a month ago. They often have histories of years, multiple different therapists they've tried or things that they've given a go, years of struggling. And it's taken years to develop those habits, and it takes time to come up with new ones. So in DBT, we do a full year with people to break through that. So it does take time, and a life worth living becomes a lifelong goal, something that I keep striving for. That I keep striving for personally, but definitely my clients as well. And DBT's aim isn't necessarily to attain that, because when do I decide that, okay, I've got it now? It's to set a trajectory towards that.
I've heard you talk about radical acceptance. Can you explain what that is?
In our world, there are some things we can change. There are challenges that are within our grasp. Like, I can solve lots of problems, like where I'm going to work or what I'm going to eat this afternoon or whatever it may be. I can solve quite complex problems. And then there are things that I don't have control over. You know, things like this COVID-19 thing at the moment, I don't have control over it. I can't tell the government what to do. I have these sanctions. I have these things that are imposed on me. I have the realities of the virus and what it's doing in the world, and I can't change that. So I can choose to battle that. I can choose to just go, it's just not fair. Like, why do we have to deal with this? I don't like this. Is this even true? Is this a conspiracy? And the more I do that, the more I kind of battle this idea, the more that causes my emotional distress, adds to it, right? On top of what makes sense given the restrictions and the challenges that come with it. So radical acceptance is my ability to then accept it, to go, oh, this sucks. I'm stuck in my house. I haven't had a hug in a long time. I really, really just want some Thai food from down the road. I hate cooking every night. I'm really worried about my family overseas. And this sucks and I can't change it. Now, the bit that makes it radical rather than just acceptance is the behavior that comes with it. So I can accept something and then not do anything about it. But radical acceptance means that I act as if I've accepted it. I act on the next thing that I'm going to do, given I've now accepted it. Instead of getting caught up in my house and stuck on my couch, I get my dog out and I go, Ralphie, we're going for a walk. I pick up the phone. Oh, I would so much rather see this person in face to face, and I'm going to do the phone call anyway. The radical bit is where my actions match my intention of acceptance. And it's a super powerful thing. It's an amazing thing when we feel really stuck in where we're at.
So that's saying yes to life just as it is.
Yeah. And all its glory and gore. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about emotional resilience?
Yeah.
I think the word comes from the Latin resiliere, to leap or spring back. And it implies an ability to bounce back from life's stressful events.
There's plenty of factors that are part of resilience, right? Some out of our control, like the big stresses we were just talking about, things like our genetics or our history, the things we can't go back and change. But these are often referred to as kind of risk factors, the factors that make it more likely that we might have difficulties. And there are many more factors that are protective factors, resilience factors, things that can help us move forward. And it starts really simple. These are the basics. If we get right down to getting enough sleep, usually around 8 to 9 hours, depending on where you're at, and it can change for young people or adults. Eating balanced and regularly. My body needs food, and my brain needs food to cope with emotions and to cope with stresses that comes up. To move. Our body has this natural reset in movement. When we engage in exercise, we burn through things like cortisol or stress hormones, and we create positive ones like endorphins. So in terms of emotional resilience, it actually starts that simple. Sleeping, eating, moving. Focusing on connections. Establishing new connections with people. Fostering existing ones. Rekindling old ones. Even ending harmful ones, to have those connections with people in our lives that can help us get through moments, to enjoy the joys and celebrations in our lives, but also get us through the sadness and challenges in our lives. So those connections become a key part to being resilient. And when we look at the literature around people who are resilient, it's right in there. Beyond all this is developing more flexibility. And this gets a little bit more intricate because it's in more flexibility in how we see the world. The D in DBT is dialectical. And dialectical, in essence, is our ability to see the world in a more flexible way, to see things how I see them and see another side. And when I can see at least two sides to every situation, it gives me more options of responding to the challenges life is going to throw at me. And the better we are at that cognitive flexibility, that ability to see the world in multiple ways, the more effective we become at rolling with the challenges that come at us. Because it doesn't always just challenge our immediate way of seeing the world, we can see it in another way, a more effective way as well.
Some quite fundamental building blocks of resilience. So it's knowing when and how to express emotions and learning from setbacks and being able to take a stretched perspective.
Yeah.
How effective do you think all these things are in terms of buffering the effects of negative life events?
Critical. Negative life events are going to have an effect on us, right? That's normal. We talked about that function of emotion, right? And when challenges come up, I want to feel sad. I want to feel anxious. And I don't want those emotions to be so big that they don't help me. If I'm thinking about, and I think anyone listening, if they're thinking about, skipping a few meals and getting hangry, or they know that person who's particularly sensitive to that, emotions are just stronger when I'm hungry, right? That night where I got super disrupted sleep for whatever reason it may be. And at the moment, people are really struggling with that, right? Because routine's out the window. That next day, I'm just a bit snappier. My emotions are bigger. So my emotions have a much higher chance of being ineffective, of being out of proportion to the situation, not helping me. So those simple factors, those things like sleeping and eating and like moving, venting to people, they are so important and they have that like absolute impact on how we cope with the things that happen in our day. Doesn't mean we're not going to feel sad about it. I wouldn't actually want that, but it might mean that my intensity is closer to being effective for me.
It has been quite an emotional roller coaster over this lockdown period and in the weeks preceding it. Just wondered if you wanted to talk about anything relating to the roller coaster as you see it from a DBT perspective.
What has really stood out for me is how it has looked different for different people. I have friends who love it. I talked to a colleague earlier this morning who were like, this has been really good. I'm spending more time at home, less time commuting. I'm still getting all my work done, but actually there's more positive things in my life. And then people who are really struggling with it, where actually routines and sleep and social connection are just dropping out of their lives, where they perhaps live alone and they're forced into a bubble of one for a long period of time. So the emotional roller coaster has had this shared global aspect to it, where everyone's to some degree experiencing this anxiety about this unknown of the situation we're in, or, you know, how's this going to look? How's it going to end? Are we going to find a vaccine soon? When will next stage happen? There's this global element to it. And then there's these individual experiences. And one thing that stood out to me is how much people are comparing their experience to someone else's. When our personal experience makes sense given our context, and I don't really need to necessarily have an experience that someone else is having because my context is different, even though there's this shared element to it. Reflecting on the kind of the roller coaster of all of this, I think everyone's on their own roller coaster, despite there being some common elements.
Yes, and I'm reminded that these times have mindful and heartful aspects because every interaction we have has an emotional effect. And being able to notice and reflect on those as part of our growth. Thank you, Martinus, for helping me explore this question about how we ride this emotional roller coaster at this time. Thank you, Martinus, for joining me, and thank you to our audience for listening.